Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on ExitCoachRadio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.
This segment of the show is brought to you by Olive Crest, and it's going to feature John Grace. And John is joining us from Investors Advantage Corp. John, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Bill. How are you?
Very good. How are you doing today?
I'm excellent. Glad to see some rain coming this way.
It's going to rain. It's going to rain big time here. So we're going to talk about, I guess, the topic I have here is put paint on that pig and sell it.
Yes.
So we're going to talk all about that. And John, tell us a little bit about your professional background, if you would.
Well, I've been licensed in insurance since 78 and in securities since 79. So it allows me to be qualified to apologize for the mistakes we make in the insurance industry, along with the mistakes we make in the securities industry.
Wonderful. All right, great. And how long has Investors Advantage Corp been in existence?
Oh, it was formed officially in 1995.
And what does Investors Advantage Corp do?
We manage money. We help people retire young and wealthy. So we work with both individuals and also with pension plans, 401ks. So it's a combination. Manage about $100 million.
Very nice. And how's business these days?
It's good. It's very good. We started the year with a new pension plan that we had to compete for, and that was quite exciting. Just before the end of the year, we geared up for it, and then the first presentation was the first week of January, and it has now closed. So that's about $15 million, and the neat thing about pension plans in particular is that the trustees are typically looking for consistency and transparency as far as fees are concerned.
Yeah, fees are a big issue these days, aren't they? I mean, the compliance has really stepped up and said fees need to be disclosed. What other trends are happening in the industry right now for you, John? What do you see happening?
You'll see more of that, Bill, because, see, the thing is that when you look at mutual funds, which all of us cut our teeth on relative to investments, the problem is the prospectus only reflects a portion of the cost. 70% of owning a mutual fund are the transaction expenses, and that's not reflected at all in a prospectus. So we are looking at, maybe 30% of the equation. So when we look at the resources or use the resources that we have to look at the total expenses, we often see that the average is about 2.4% before the advisor receives a dime. Those are all the internal costs. Some of the most popular funds are more like 6, 7, 8% per year. But again, the transaction fees aren't reflected, so the total costs are about, as we see them, 50 to 100% off.
Now, at what point do people say, okay, I've had enough of that and I have enough money now to invest in another medium that doesn't charge retail fees like that, John?
Well, the way I would look at it, it's not so much about the fees. I mean, really, the fees are a drag in a rising market. And if you looked at some of the most popular, very inexpensive funds, like one that was formed about mid-70s, I wish I had formed it, it's all about the fees. But let's look at it this way. When the market was off 37%, as it was in 2008, and a low-fee account was off 41%, well, you tell me what the low fees did for you. you didn't save any money. In fact, you were down greater than maybe some of the more expensive positions. So it's really what it does for the investor relative to the investor's goals. And fees are only a part of that equation. They can't drive the decision in terms of, well, I got the lowest cost. Well, at the end of the day, you're trying to make sure you have enough money, and cost, as I say, is a factor, but it's not a driver.
That makes sense. But I guess what I was getting at is there a point that you see where somebody, let's say they have $100,000,
mm-hmm.
and they're still in the old retail mutual fund,
mm-hmm.
is that a good bargain for them, or should they be? Is there a point at which they should be looking for an institutionally priced type of an arrangement, or is it $500,000, or is it some other benchmark for investors to look at?
It could be as little as $25,000. I mean, going back to examples that we're just discussing, where the market's off 37, many mutual funds are off that or more, NASDAQ was off 60, there's some institutional managers that were off, let's say, 20% or less in 2008, primarily because they had active management strategies in the equation that mutual funds just can't do. Yet. They really haven't evolved since the 40s, okay? But some of the active management arrangements certainly took money off the table in 2008. Let's say the portfolio started 60% stocks and 40% bonds, for example. Well, you wouldn't have been disappointed to see that the account was more like 45% stocks, 55% bonds in 2008. More importantly, the investor was only off 19.84, or roughly 20%. So you're still in the game if you're only down 20% as opposed to off 40 or more. And then in 2009, the active management strategies got more aggressive in a very good year. So now the swing went from 45% stocks to 75% stocks. Market's up about 30. This account was up about 31. So what that says is, irrespective, or let's say net of all costs, the account was actually worth more on 12/31/2009 as compared to 1/1/08, as compared to all of our friends who didn't get back to even until 12/31/12.
Okay. So let's change channels for just a second. And what's the immediate future for residential real estate? I understand you have some outlook in that area.
Yes, I do. And let me say it this way. To me, it's never always the same, which means that it all depends on who we're talking to. So if I'm talking to a rocket scientist at Raytheon, for example, mid-40s, making $250,000 a year, his wife also is fully employed, they have three children, it's like buy whatever you like, and you're going to enjoy it because you're going to live in it. You've got three young kids. It doesn't really matter what house prices do. And these folks are going to have $4 or $5 million anyway outside the real estate, unlike most of us. So regardless if the house is paid for or not, you know, their net worth isn't all tied up in an illiquid position. They're going to have $4 or $5 million outside of the house anyway. The rest of us, let's say the 50, 60, 70-year-olds, what we're saying is this. Let me paint the picture a little as well as I possibly can. And this information, I think, is the most telling, and you're not getting this information. From 1980 to 2000, 40% of all the homes purchased in the country were on lot sizes of 0.5 acre to 10 acres in size. That's huge. These are not condos. These were McMansions. These were bought by the boomers in the suburbs, okay? And so these were larger homes, exponentially, than the ones boomers grew up in, on larger lots, exponentially, than they grew up in a brand new location. So here's what we're saying. If the boomers had their way with diapers and Whammo and Mustangs and Schwinn and college educations of the demand for real estate at interest rates at 16%, okay, and everybody was surprised, well, now we see the evidence just looking at what average people are doing, kind of like they're following us all around. You know, all of us bought the big house in the same 20-year period. Well, let's see. George W., I believe, turned 68 this year, born 1946. Michelle Obama turns 50 this year, so 1964. Well, let's see. That means that the eldest of the boomers are 68, the youngest is 50. What's going to be next? Is it reasonable, in your opinion, that if we roughly bought all of the big houses on the big lots in the same 20-year period, that we might be getting out of those houses for various reasons in a similar time frame?
Mm-hmm.
It's reasonable to me. So what we're saying is, to those, like I say, the 50, 60, and 70-year-olds, put paint on that pig and sell it. Put that house up for sale. Get your cash. Do not wait, because you may find that we're in the beginning of another downturn as far as real estate that might be more than 10%. It might be 30%. And who would like to see that happen again when you need the money?
Very interesting. We're talking with John Grace of Investors Advantage Corp. And John, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to ask you to share a few stories and some tips, ideas, and precautions for our listeners. So hang on just a second. We'll be right back.
stock market peak? As we begin a new year with the stock market at all-time highs, it could be valuable to look at a recent pattern of the market from 2012 to 2013 that may rhyme with 1928 to 1929. It's not about the prediction, it's all about the preparation for what may happen. Get ready now for what may be the worst hypothetical scenario. As the Dow near 17,000, be proactive and give your portfolio a stress test. For any strategy to work, it needs to be in place prior to an event. Call now for your free stress test at 805-495-2077 or 888-YB-POOR. That's 888-WHY-BE-POOR. Securities and advisory services offered through National Planning Corporation, NPC, member FINRA, SIPC, a registered investment advisor. Investors Advantage and NPC are separate and unrelated companies. Indices are unmanaged measures of market conditions. It's not possible to invest directly into an index. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results.
Hi, everybody. This is Spike Reel with The Exit Coach. Business owners, can you name the 8 key value drivers that you and your managers should be focusing on to increase the value of your business? Introducing the Sellability Score Index. Visit our website and answer 25 questions about your business, and you will instantly receive your sellability score, showing you how well you stack up in the 8 value driver areas. It's a great management tool. It's absolutely free for our listeners. Just visit exitcoachradio.com and click Get My Sellability Score.
Welcome back, friends. Just a reminder that we've interviewed dozens of advisors on a wide variety of topics, and you'll find all of their interviews and highlights online at exitcoachradio.com or on iTunes. And I'm talking with John Grace of Investors Advantage Corp. And John, before the break, that was an interesting subject matter we started to get into, the fact that the baby boomers who bought the McMansions are now getting to the point where they're going to start reversing that trend and selling off, and who's going to buy on the back end. Is that the gist of it?
Well, that's exactly right. I think there, you know, certainly, is particularly if you look at the last couple of years, people are saying, well, I'm going to get more, right? We get greedy again. But here's the thing. See, peak spending in America occurs in mid-40s. So if we look at the boomers who drove the economy through all the history that we're all trying to revert to, we're in uncharted territory. We don't like debt the way we used to. You don't need the big house anymore. You've finally educated the kids. They're out of the house. You look at each other going, what do we need this for? But if you look at it like this, again, looking at ordinary people, we learned in the last two elections, it's Ohio. It's not the fringe states, the coasts that drive the election. It's Homer Simpson, okay, making $50,000 a year. So we've got 76 million people who did everything in a very big way, only because they were so large in number. Well, there's a trough. In other words, the next group of 40-year-olds is not nearly as large as the people from 50 to 68 today, which means that the same folks who bought those big houses will be getting out, I think, about the same time, again, for various reasons, not all pleasant, and they're going to be looking to get as much dollar as they can, only the group's going to be smaller. The next group of 70 to 80 million people in our country is roughly 20-something. So if you look at the boomers' kids at 20-somethings, by the way, they don't like the suburbs, but they're not making the kind of money in the 20s, and many of them don't have the same education. So these folks that are going to be needing all this cash may find that they're trying to get out at the same time when there are fewer number of people who can afford the million, $2 million homes in the suburbs. So they're going to be racing for the exits, and it may very well be that the number of people dying outweigh the number of people buying.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I've noticed in my area down here in Irvine, California, there's a ton of apartment-style places going up. The construction companies and the developers certainly are in tune with what you're saying. Smaller places.
Well, they read it. I mean, and the neat thing is, see, the boomers don't want the big house anymore. They want to call the landlord and say, hey, Bill, come replace the light bulb, and that's what happens. Mm-hmm. Well, the 20-somethings are doing the same thing. They're like, geez, I don't want to get out there and mow that lawn and paint that darn thing like Dad did. That's stupid. I'd love to go play. I'd love to travel, you know, but the demand for rental real estate is certainly a lot larger, higher than it is for residential purchasing.
Great point. Well, I want to get your opinion on something else, John. You've got some great opinions here. We're officially out of the Great Recession, right? So what's next?
Well, I think that's a very good question. And the way I like to put it is, let's not try to predict the future. Let's prepare for the future. I mean, if you're in Irvine or, you know, in Newport Beach, for example, and you have a 7.6 earthquake off of Catalina, you know, and you're prepared for that, you'll probably survive to tell the story. If you're not prepared for that, you might be a statistic. So the way I look at it is, instead of looking at the 70-year averages, let's look at the worst-case scenario and see how we might learn from that and then prepare. And that, of course, would be the Great Depression. And, you know, if you look at 1928, 29, let's suppose you were around and you had $1 million at that particular time. Well, Bill, I've run the numbers. That's what we do. And by 1932 to 33, $1 million was worth about $108,000. Wow. Now imagine the decisions you make as a millionaire. You know, I mean, you could get 4% on $1 million, that's $40,000 income. If you got $108,000, how do you feel? For the folks who say, well, it's buy and hold, which is a lot of what we've all been taught and what we have taught our investors to do, I got good news for you. Yes, you did get back to even. Your 108 had to get 1,000% to get back to $1 million. It did so about 1955.
Wow.
That's the good news.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the other side of the equation. Who would have been around in the same stocks they owned for 22 years? Who also did not take out any money? I mean, do you know of anybody, Bill, who doesn't need any money over a 20-year period?
No.
I can't think of anybody, including me. So my point is, if we look at that worst-case scenario, 10 cents on the dollar, and let's suppose it were to occur again, how might we protect our assets or at least make them not, or keep them in places that don't decline as severely as the markets might, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We've been through two times. Were they warning signs? 00 to 02, 2008. Is there, you know, a grand slam around the corner? I don't know. I can't tell the future. But what many of us don't do is look to see whether it was 28, 29 to 32, 33, 00 to 02, 07 to 08. Each of those times were very painful. And if we were working, putting money in, we didn't feel the pain. In fact, it was probably a good time to add to the account. But if we're living off that money, we may be dead in the water. So what can we do? What can we learn? How can we discover things that held up better or didn't decline as severely when it looked like the Titanic was going down to never see the day of, you know, the light of day again?
I'm on the edge of my seat. Why don't you give our listeners a couple tips or ideas or precautions, John? What can we do to prepare for the good, the bad, and the ugly here?
Well, I would say there's a couple of things. As I say, go back, ask better questions. Do not be satisfied with the averages. Do not be complacent. Look to see if you can diversify, unlike you've ever done before. If we go back to mutual funds, again, we all cut our teeth there. There's really only three options: cash, bonds, and stocks. So what's the hedge to stocks? Maybe it's commodities. What's the hedge to bonds? Maybe it's real estate investment trusts or, you know, publicly traded, privately traded. What's the hedge to the U.S. dollar? Well, of course, it would be currencies. And then how can we put guarantees in the equation? So now we've taken our net worth that we might have to live off of and taken and put went from three legs underneath the stool to six or seven legs underneath the stool. Certainly, it's more substantial if we have more legs in the equation. So as I say, we want to diversify unlike we've ever done before. And then the second one, Bill, is to apply active management strategies. It's not going to guarantee that there isn't a loss necessarily, but we got to have a mechanism where somebody's awake at the switch, let's say on a daily basis, looking at your money and becoming more defensive, taking money, let's say, out of risky positions in a bad year like 2008, and becoming more defensive, putting money back on, you know, so we get defensive in 08, and then in 09, when it's a good market, we increase the exposure to, let's say, risky assets like stocks, for example, so that maybe we can get the gains that the market might afford us, and again, get back to even, and maybe even a little further, earlier than waiting 5 years or so to get back to even, and again, that's assuming we didn't take out any money.
So I like your strategy of adding legs to the stool. Rather than looking at your traditional stocks, bonds, and cash, you want to add some alternative types of strategies and get outside the box, if you will.
Yes, yes. And in fact, if you look at like Yale and Cornell and Harvard, during the same time that the average investor, let's say 60-40 stocks bond combination, did a whopping 1.5% per year, these foundations and endowments did 5.1% per year. Well, if we look under the hood a little bit, I mean, clearly that's a remarkable difference. But if we look under the hood, we can see that they have, like you're talking about, alternatives, things that are other than cash, bonds, and stocks, and their exposure to cash, bonds, and stocks is a lot less than one would expect, but they held up a whole lot better. So maybe, you know, we can learn from the smart money, if you will, and see how we might be able to fold some of what these endowments and foundations have done successfully that might work for us too.
Great stuff. So, John, how do people reach you, get in touch with you, and do you have any kind of a free consultation offer or something like that for our listeners?
Oh, I sure do. We've been doing this since the holidays, and it's actually what we call take advantage of stress testing your portfolio. So, you know, you can go back to 08, you can go back to maybe 2000, and for example, look at, okay, how did I do? How bad did it get? I'm glad I'm back to even, but like I say, what could I learn? Was there a way to keep my account more whole, if you will, in 2000 and 2002, and again 2007 and 2008. This helps us see how we might be better prepared the next time it gets ugly. Because see, it's never the bus you see. It's always the bus you don't see, can't name, and can't time that can disrupt your day when you're trying to get across the street for lunch.
Good point. How do people get in touch with you?
805-495-2077. And certainly they can visit our website, ybepoor.com, W-H-Y-B-E-P-O-O-R.com. We do webinars and things of that nature. We do like for people to get involved and to learn as much as they possibly can, because at the end of the day, it's their money.
So I encourage everybody, get in touch with John Grace of Investors Advantage Corp. John, thanks very much for spending some time with us today. It's been a fun interview and very insightful. Hope you'll come back and join us again sometime.
Look forward to it, Bill. So thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. I've been talking with John Grace of Investors Advantage Corp. We're going to take a short break, so please stay tuned.
At ExitCoachRadio.com, we're interviewing over 100 top advisors to get you one-minute tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. We upload new content daily at 6 a.m. and 1 p.m. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute. Thank you for listening to Exit Coach Radio.